Welcome to the Medicinal Herbs Podcast. In this episode, host Dr. Dana Parent talks with naturopath and medical herbalist Baris Burgoyne about the gut microbiome, dysbiosis, and the role of nutrition and herbs in supporting gut health.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Medicinal Herbs Podcast from Holistic Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Dana Parent, and this month we have Baris Burgoyne. She's been in clinical practice for 33 years as a naturopath in Australia, and she lectures regularly in the United States. Welcome, Baris. So great to have you here today.
Thank you very much.
And I want to start off, we hear a lot about dysbiosis, especially in recent years. What exactly is dysbiosis?
Well, look, the term dysbiosis really refers to any detrimental change in the population of microbial species in a certain area of the body. And it could be the loss of beneficial microbes from that area, or it may be the overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria, or it might be the loss of diversity of bacteria. And in many cases, though, I think it's a combination of all of these three things that actually contribute to dysbiosis. And usually when we're talking about dysbiosis, we're referring to the lower gut, the colon, and that's certainly what I'm going to be focusing on today. But it's really important to remember that there's a natural microbiome throughout the gut, including the mouth. And indeed, there's microbiome in many other areas of the body, the lungs, the skin, the nails, the eyes, etc. So it's quite a long list where we find microbiome. And I have read research talking about the microbiome of the blood as well. So it's very, very interesting. But today we're focusing on microbiome of the lower gut.
And exactly why is the gut microbiome so important?
Look, how long's a piece of string, really? It's just fundamentally important. And it's very interesting that when I was studying to be a naturopath, you know, a very long time ago, almost 40 years ago, I started my studies. You know, we were taught that the gut is really important. Indeed, Hippocrates talked about the importance of the gut back, you know, 300-400 years BC. So it's not a new idea, but it is a new idea in modern medicine, because for a long time that the whole notion of the gut playing a role was lost. And when I was at college, If you mentioned to a doctor that, you know, something about the gut having an influence somewhere else, that you'd be laughed at, because they thought the gut's the gut and it can't influence anything. But of course, in the last couple of decades, there's a huge amount of research on this topic. And I think it's really fair to say that I don't think that there's an organ, a tissue, a system or a process in the body that is not affected by the lower gut microbiome in some way, either directly or indirectly. But what we do know is that the lower gut microbiome regulates the nervous system, it regulates immune function, not just in the gut itself, but systemically. It also regulates our metabolism. So if you have dysbiosis, you may be more likely to put on weight, depending, you know, on your genetics and your diet, of course. The gut bacteria are also really important for improving the absorption of nutrients from the food we eat, or indeed the supplements that we take. And the bacteria also produce some vitamins, some of the B vitamins and vitamin K, for instance. Importantly, you know, we see a lot of inflammation in our patients these days, and often it's long-term chronic inflammation. And we know that the gut microbiome helps to regulate inflammation, not just in the gut, but also systemically. And indeed, if you have a leaky gut, you will be leaking endotoxin into the circulation, and that will cause systemic inflammation. And we know that LPS, which is really how endotoxin is referred to in the literature, lipopolysaccharide, we know it can cross the blood-brain barrier. So if that happens, you're going to have neuroinflammation as well. So if you've got dysbiosis in the gut, you will have a leaky gut and you'll have all of these things happening. So we really have to make sure that the bacteria in the gut are in the correct balance and we don't have, you know, this whole scenario which affects our whole body health happening. And I've been reading a lot about this recently, and researchers are saying that the species and the type of microbiome or microbiota in the gut are very important, but probably more important is the types and balance of the short-chain fatty acids that are being produced by those bacteria. And we get the production of these short-chain fatty acids, you know, via the gut bacteria working on fiber that's not absorbed. It just goes through the gut. And you get action by the bacteria, you get fermentation of that fiber. And that's what produces the short-chain fatty acids. And they're really important in the link between the communication between different bacteria in the gut, but also with the host itself, with our overall body health. So, you know, it's very, very complex and very fascinating. But if we've got dysbiosis, we will have inflammation in the gut. We may or may not have gut symptoms to start with, but we will certainly have problems systemically as well. And they may take a while to manifest, but they will certainly be there.
And you mentioned a really important concept here, you know, this leaky gut. You know, speaking of endotoxins leaking into our bodies, you know, what does that look like? What health issues are we likely to see as a result of dysbiosis?
Well, look, you could see a whole range of health issues. You're going to see low-grade systemic inflammation, and you may not develop a lot of symptoms of that for a long time, potentially. And what does go wrong, what diseases or ill health you might manifest from that, it's going to depend on your genetics, it's going to depend on your lifestyle and your diet. But, you know, I mentioned that we can get neuroinflammation as a result of this. And neuroinflammation is being found to be a component in every psychiatric illness, things like chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, addictions, obsessive compulsive disorder, a whole range of things. And probably that list will keep getting added to as we learn more about it. So I think the problems that can result from dysbiosis largely will depend on where you get the most inflammation in the body, and that will depend a lot on your genetics and what kind of conditions you're susceptible to due to your genetics.
And why do you think so many people appear to have dysbiosis? You know, you mentioned genetics. What are some other contributing factors?
Well, you know, some researchers have said that most diseases affecting Westernized countries are associated with dysbiosis and the loss of microbial diversity in the gut. So we can change the way we live to start with. And, you know, one of the really big factors that impacts on our gut microbiota or microbiome is our diet. And in Western societies, we generally have a fairly unhealthy diet if you compare it to many other countries, and particularly people still living more their traditional lifestyle in other countries, and perhaps in our countries too, if we're aware of that and if they're able to do so. So, you know, I think in your country, in my country, a lot of people, for the majority of their diet or a large portion of their diet, is going to consist of highly processed foods. Now, these processed foods are not only high in calories, they're also low in nutrition. Really, there's not much in them that, you know, and I really think we shouldn't even be calling them foods, quite honestly. I don't know what we can call them. It's stuff that fills your stomach, but I don't think we can call them food because they don't provide what food is supposed to provide us. So, and they're certainly low in fiber, and fiber is really important because we know that those short-chain fatty acids, and you need fiber for the production of those, they're key in all the communication and regulation that the gut microbiome is responsible for. So diet is fundamental, and we can talk more about what to do about diet shortly. But another important consideration is antibiotics. Everybody knows that antibiotics disrupt gut health and the gut microbiome. But what most people aren't aware of is that a significant source of antibiotics that we're exposed to don't come from getting a prescription from the doctor when you've got a bacterial infection. They come from our food. 65% of medically important antibiotics sold in the United States are used in food-producing animals. Only 33% of antibiotics used in the US are prescribed to humans to deal with bacterial infection. So when we eat the meat or the other animal products, eggs, milk, etc., from animals fed antibiotics, we are exposed to low-dose antibiotics. And one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why they will often give food-producing animals antibiotics. One is that they're often kept in fairly appalling conditions, and so they succumb to infection. But one of the major reasons is they found that if they give low-dose long-term antibiotics to animals, it fattens them up more. And I think that's really interesting, because I suspect the reason the animals are being fattened up is because the antibiotics are creating dysbiosis in those animals. And so their metabolism goes awry. And we know that, you know, dysbiosis in humans can increase weight. So, you know, very, very, very interesting. So I'll talk more about how we can get around that shortly as well. But we don't only have an effect on the microbiome with antibiotics. All of this can contribute to antibiotic resistance. And we know this is a huge problem facing the modern world. And the World Health Organization has talked about that we may be approaching a time where antibiotics are ineffective. And once again, we may be seeing children die from scratching their knee and getting an infection because there's nothing to fight. It's a very difficult and important subject. So, and in the United States, tens of thousands of people die every year after they've contracted an antibiotic resistant infection. So it's a big problem. And eating animal products that contain antibiotics is contributing to this. And in fact, many antibiotics that have in the past been used in the food producing industry are now banned in that industry because we've seen such antibiotic resistance. And another important factor that will decrease the gut health is stress. And stress is underestimated. We know that stress can have a detrimental impact on all areas of our health. And, you know, part of that reason, maybe not the only reason, but part of that reason is because it can also cause dysbiosis. And this has been shown in quite a lot of research. If you get stressed, your microbiome in the lower gut actually changes. And it makes you less able to cope with stress. And to make matters worse, dysbiosis itself, from any cause, can reduce your ability to deal with stress further and link to conditions like depression, anxiety, etc. So it's sort of like a two-way street. Once you have one of these, you're probably going to, at some point, develop the other. Again, depending on your genetics. If you have a susceptibility to not coping very well or to depression, anxiety, dysbiosis can certainly bring that on much more than it would happen otherwise. But diet, I think, is one of the key things, and probably the in a sense, the easiest thing to modify with our patients. We can't always escape stress. Of course, it's herbs and nutrients we can use to help the body cope with stress. But diet is a very, very modifiable way of changing the gut microbiome.
Baris, I just have to laugh because when you talked about a lot of your patients are not even consuming foods anymore, I always tell my patients that they're consuming food-like products. So it's not food, it's food-like products.
I wouldn't even say they're food-like, but yes, I'll give you that.
I And so I know you mentioned some of those contributing factors of dysbiosis. You know, what is the advice we give to our patients? You know, you talked about diet. You know, what are some other things that we talk to our patients about in clinical practice?
Look, I think diet, as I said, is really important. And it's really not rocket science, you know. We don't need to be adding any weird and wonderful and really expensive foods to our consumption each day. We just need to use, I think, common sense, and we eat a diet that's high in fresh fruit, vegetables, more vegetables than fruit for most people, nuts, seeds, legumes, grains. So whole foods, in other words. Now, I understand that some people have dietary restrictions that may exclude them from having grains or legumes, etc. And that's fine. If that's the case, there's plenty of other food, whole foods that you can eat if you're not eating those things. But whole food, I mean, it's common sense, really. It's common sense. Look back and, you know, before we had all the processed foods, what did people eat? Well, you know, we know that the Mediterranean diet, the true Mediterranean diet, not the one where you have pasta with every meal, that's a westernized Mediterranean diet, but the true Mediterranean diet, it's got a lot of these things in. It was a peasant diet. So they ate fruit and vegetables that they grew or foraged in the hills. They ate whole foods. They ate a lot of legumes because they're cheap. So whole food is really, really important. And of course, all of those things are a very rich source of fiber. And you don't have to think about fiber. If you're eating those foods, you don't have to think about diet or fiber. But we know that the majority of people don't get enough servings of vegetables in a day, for example, in your country and my country, and we know that people don't get enough fiber in their diet. So I think it's no wonder we're seeing an epidemic of obesity, of type 2 diabetes, and a whole range of chronic diseases. It's not just because we're living longer, it's because so many of us are eating a really bad diet and we have poor gut health. And yeah, along with these high fiber foods, of course, we have to have adequate protein, but we have to get that protein from good sources. It can be animal based or it can be plant based. And for many people, it's a combination of both. And we do see a trend now that, you know, more people are trying to include plant based protein into their diets as well. And that doesn't only make sense from, in my opinion, from a health point of view. I know there's differing opinions, but that's my opinion. But also it's much cheaper. If you eat a meal with some legumes, some lentils or some chickpeas or, you know, kidney beans or something, that's a much cheaper meal than going to your supermarket or your butcher and buying a piece of steak for the family. So that, you know, it's much, much cheaper. And I think combining the two is a very, very healthy way to live. And we know that when they've done research in populations around the world, and they do a lot of this in areas of in the African continent, that where you've got people that are living more their traditional lifestyle, not totally, because I don't think that's possible anymore, but they're largely living their traditional lifestyle, they have a much greater number of bacteria in the gut and, you know, a greater diversity of different species in the gut than in developed countries. And researchers have taken people and plonked them in with these societies, and people have eaten the food there, and within a reasonable short of time, period of time, they see huge changes in their gut microbiome. But of course, if those people come back to the United States and just eat what they ate before, that effect is not going to last very long. But it does show that diet, if we can correct our diet, we can correct our gut health. And that's pretty easy to do. And for most of us, I think it'll be cheaper. I often hear from my patients, oh, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables are so expensive. I can go and buy, you know, a burger from the local, you know, the Golden Arches for, you know, for a dollar or two, and that's much cheaper. But really, if you think, if you go and buy a cabbage or something, you know, of course you've got to add other things to it, but you're going to get a lot of meals out of that. It's not just one. So I think when you buy some fruit and vegetables, when you buy some legumes, for example, you might be spending more upfront, but overall it's going to be cheaper because you're going to get a lot more meals out of it. And without doubt, it's going to be healthier. But I think we are cultures, your country and mine, of instant gratification. And, you know, we don't necessarily want to go and shop and cook food. You know, we can just go to the local fast food shop and get it instantly. And these days, you know, when I'm talking about obesity, I often sort of laugh and say, look, we don't even have to get off the couch and walk to the car, you know, a couple of feet, and then park outside the shop and walk a couple of feet into the shop. We can continue lying on the couch, holding on to our TV remote control and get our food delivered to us. So, you know, everything is so instant now. But for many of my patients who have started like that, when I can really educate them about food and they get into cooking and they get into buying good food, they really start enjoying that whole process. And, you know, I must admit, I have had the odd person and some mothers with young children who after a while will just ring up and cancel an appointment and say, look, I can't just keep cooking every day. I just don't have time for it. And I think what sort of society are we living in where people can't cook food for their children? They would rather buy highly processed foods. And look, we can be smart about it. We don't have to cook every day. You know, you can have things that you can make other meals out of that are left over. We can freeze things. We can preserve things. We don't have to cook meals every day if we're smart about it. So, you know, there's ways of doing it, but I think we've all just got into this instant gratification. And also with highly processed fast foods, because they really don't contain much nutrition, if any, then our body's not satisfied. So we want to eat more of it, or we want to eat again very soon afterwards. They might fill us quickly, but they're not sustaining. The body is after more nutrition. So it's telling us you need to eat something else. And of course, it's in a lot of cases, it's going to be more fast food. So I think we have to change the way that we think about food, the way that we think about our lives. And it's part of our job as clinicians, I think, to educate people to that.
And I really love this big picture concept that healthy foods don't have to be expensive. You know, possibly a bit more time consuming, but not necessarily more expensive.
No, that's right. And you can choose what you buy. You know, sometimes supermarkets or wherever you buy your food will have specials, or if you buy things in season, they're always going to be cheaper. So, you know, I live in the subtropics and I do grow some low chill blueberries, but generally buying fresh berries where I live are fairly expensive because a lot of them don't grow here. But, you know, I'm always a bit envious when I'm in parts of the United States and you see these big platters of berries that are growing locally. So buy them when they're cheap and freeze them. So then you've got them. And, you know, if you do buy things like that when they're in season or eat food that's in season, it's much, much cheaper. You know, we've been a little bit spoiled, if you like, with always having things available to us, everything we want. And I think, you know, really it would be much better for us and the planet if we went back to thinking about, so what's in season, what's growing more locally that I can eat? Because not only are you going to save a whole lot of food miles, you're also going to be eating food that's fresher and cheaper.
That's a really great point.
Like I said before.
That is a really great point. And then, you know, probably another big picture concept that our listeners want to hear about, besides for just changing the diet, you know, can this dysbiosis be rectified? Is it enough to just change our diet, or what else do our patients have to do?
Really, diet is the key. And, you know, I talked before about, you know, good quality protein, etc. So my advice to patients is always, if you're eating animal protein, please try and buy it that it's organic or it's free range. Try and make sure it's antibiotic free. Now, I know that's not always going to be available, and of course it will be more expensive than, you know, factory raised animals. It will be more expensive, but my advice to people is that if you can't get it or you can't afford it, then don't eat so much of it. Eat less of it and bring in more plant-based food. And, you know, I'm lucky where I live and, you know, I can get access to good quality animal protein. But if I couldn't, I would eat much, much less of it than I do. So that's, you know, we just need to remember the antibiotics. And also the way those animals are raised, they're going to be full of stress hormones as well that is going to be passed on to us. So that's not going to be good for us as well. Manage our stress as best we can. We can't eliminate stress, but manage it as best we can. You know, as I said, there's herbs and there's nutrients that we can use to help the body cope with stress better and have a more responsive HPA axis, stress response, etc. But we can do things like do a little bit of yoga, just take a little bit of time out, just to sort of take a few deep breaths and be really present in your body. And you can do that when you're driving a car. You can do it on a phone conversation. You don't have to put aside half an hour to do these things. If you do some of those things regularly throughout the day, it does help you cope with stress a little bit more. Just something like breathing in for maybe the count of four, but then breathing out for the count of six or eight. Just doing that breathing out longer than you're breathing in really resets the autonomic nervous system, takes you out of the sympathetic dominance and puts you more into parasympathetic and just balances it. And those sorts of things are really easy to do. We just have to get into the habit of doing it. They don't take more time. We just have to get into the habit of actually doing them. But look, in addition to all of this advice that I give my patients, I also will very often put them on a herbal weed feed and seed protocol. Now that, you know, that's what I call it, and people understand that, you know, it's really a gut flora balance protocol that we use for dysbiosis. And that works by 2 days a week, patients will take a herbal antimicrobial. So that they're herbs that help to reduce the number of the pathogenic organisms in the gut. And if you can reduce the pathogenic organisms, the beneficial bacteria are going to multiply because there's going to be more space in there in order for them to do so. And the sort of herbs that I use there would be a herb called philodendron, and that contains berberine. And we've known for, 50 years or more, that berberine is an excellent gut antimicrobial. And philodendron contains a good amount of berberine. And I also use with that the essential oils of oregano and anise and oregano essential oil. There's quite a lot of research on that as a good gut antimicrobial. I use other immune herbs there like andrographis, etc. So that's just taken 2 days a week. And then the other 5 days a week, they do what we call the feeding and seeding phase. That first 2 days is a weeding phase because we're weeding out the unbeneficial bacteria. But in the weeding and seeding and feeding stage, we're giving probiotics that are reseeding the gut with beneficial organisms, and we're feeding the beneficial ones that are there with prebiotics. And prebiotics is fiber. So you can use a fiber supplement. And in most cases, you'll need to use a supplement, at least short term. And if you can use one that is fiber from a wide variety of sources and preferably a mixture of soluble and unsoluble fiber, then you're going to be feeding and looking after a greater diversity of bacteria. When I talk about the fact that we need fiber in our diet, and to eat, you know, eat more vegetables, for example, you can't just eat pumpkin as your only vegetable. You can't just choose one vegetable and eat it, because different bacteria in the gut prefer different types of fiber. So if we're going to have a lot of diversity, our diet needs to be a diverse mix of whole foods from one source or another. So that's a feeding and seeding phase. Now, in addition to that, I also use other herbs, including green tea and grapeseed, because we know that these herbs, they contain a group of constituents called polyphenols, and these have wide-reaching health effects in the body. But one thing that they do is they help to suppress the growth of pathogenic organisms in the gut and encourage the growth of the beneficial ones. So that's something else that I do at this time. And another consideration is the upper gut digestion. So what's happening in the stomach? You know, many people, particularly as we age, we develop a condition called hypo or achlorhydria, where we have a reduced amount of hydrochloric acid production in the stomach. And we know that that's very important, not only to deal with bacteria that we might ingest, but also for the digestive process. And we know that if you've got low hydrochloric acid in your stomach, you can have lower gut dysbiosis, and indeed you can also have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO. So we really need to make sure that our patients have good upper digestive function. And so I use a combination of bitter herbs for that, things like gentian, wormwood, feverfew, et cetera, because we know that they improve the production of hydrochloric acid and other secretions in the gut. And if we can get the stomach working correctly, we've got more chance of everything else below that working well. So there's a number of different steps there, and it may sound complex, but really it's not. It's, you know, when you explain it to your patients, they're just fine with it. And, you know, so 7 days a week, they might be taking the upper digestive support, the combination with the green tea and grapeseed. And then, you know, 2 days a week, they take the antimicrobial. 5 days a week, they take the prebiotics and the probiotics. And people get into that very, very quickly. And so that's a week cycle that we're using there. And I would normally do this for about 6 weeks, sometimes up to 10, depending on the patient and depending on what's going on. And I don't only use this protocol when there's obvious gut issues. I've used it in patients that have come in with a whole range of different things that, you know, I had a patient once who came in and she said, look, I haven't had eczema for many, many, many years, and suddenly I've got it again and I cannot control it. It wasn't very severe, but she could not get rid of it. And so I talked to her, and one of my first questions in that sort of instance is, have you had antibiotics in the last 12 months? And she'd had antibiotics about 3 or 4 months previously. So I just said, all right, first and foremost, let's do this gut protocol. And I don't think I did anything else with her to start with. And explain, you've got to explain why you're doing this, because, you know, people say, well, there's nothing wrong with my gut, why are you doing that? We need to explain the connection. And I saw her in 2 weeks and the eczema was totally gone. So, and of course, you don't stop treatment then, you keep going for the full 6 weeks. But that's a really good example where even when you think you might not be thinking that gut's involved, if you ask the right questions and think outside the box a little bit and come back to the idea that the gut is involved in everything, then, you know, you can think about that and treat it accordingly. So, you know, I think the amount of gut dysbiosis in our patients, or a number of patients that have it, I think is really underestimated. And I really believe that we probably need to do gut work in the majority of patients that walk through our clinic doors. We may not be able to do it immediately, but I think at some point in time, we need to maybe introduce it.
And that's such a great clinical example, using the weed, seed, and feed protocol for a skin manifestation. So I really love that. So thank you so much for sharing. I know we're coming up to the end here. Is there anything else you would like to add before we finish?
Look, this is such a big topic. The whole topic of the gut and the gut microbiome is absolutely huge. And we've really only just scratched the surface of it in this session. Now, I am presenting a webinar on gut health in July. And in that, I'll be giving much, much more detail about gut health and how we can manage it, particularly with herbal medicine. And overall, we've got a lot to learn about the gut. Modern science and, you know, our current understanding of the gut microbiome has also only just scratched the surface. There's a heap more to learn. And if you do a PubMed search, for example, on something like dysbiosis, just in the last year, you'll come up with literally thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of research on it. So it's a huge topic, lots of research. So we're constantly learning more and more. But even though we've only scratched the surface in this short time, I do hope that we've improved the basic understanding and ignited everybody's interest a little bit to delve further into this topic, to read about more about it, to read the research, and to attend seminars associated with this topic, because somebody's done all the hard work for you and read the research and put it together. So hopefully you'll be able to attend my webinar in July.
Barris, thank you so much for that information. Extremely relevant. We hear the term dysbiosis all the time. So thank you for all of your insights and giving us some useful clinical information for our listeners.
Thank you very much for listening to me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again for listening to the Holistic Matters podcast. For more on medicinal herbs and nutrition education, visit holisticmatters.com. That's holistic with a W. Holistic Matters is powered by Standard Process.